Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. And thank you for joining us on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. Good to have you back with us. And first up for this year, it's welcome once again to Andrew West, presenter of the Religion and Ethics Report on ABC Radio National, RN, as it's known to its fond followers. Andrew, good to have you with us.
It's great to be back, John.
Andrew, there's some big issues coming up this year. We might touch on a few of those a little later on.
Indeed.
But there's one or two things which we can't let go by that are confronting us at the moment. Internationally, Syria continues to make the headlines. We're seeing it increasingly seen in sectarian terms, but these sectarian issues are now spilling over to make it a war about borders as much as anything.
They are indeed. With the sort of sputtering nature of these peace talks that were taking place in Geneva, and then again, were they really peace talks or were they simply about a cessation of the violence? Whatever. It focuses attention on this question of whether the sectarian nature of the violence in Syria, that is Sunni Muslims aided by money and fighters from the Gulf region coming in to fight the Alawite government aligned loosely to the Shia, whether that tension is spilling over, particularly into neighbouring Lebanon. And why is the Lebanese issue so critical? Because Lebanon itself suffered a sectarian war, 15-year civil war, 1975 to 1990. Since then, it's reached a very delicate political settlement involving all the major religious groups. And that could be, you know, destabilized by what's happening in Syria. It is very fragile, Lebanon.
You've also got a situation in which, if you go back historically, the settlement of the borders in that whole region flowed out of the British Mandate and other things as a result of the conference at the end of World War One,
collapse of the Ottoman Empire. Yeah.
And those borders have never really matched the ethnic distributions.
That's right. And this is an interesting point that was made by an astute observer of the region, Martin Chulov, an Australian journalist who reports for The Guardian. He's been in the region for 6-7 years now, initially reporting out of Israel, then out of Iraq, now based in Lebanon. He made the point in some commentary for The Guardian and for us, in the past few days, that we could be seeing, ultimately, a redrawing of national borders. If not in a formal sense, what you might end up with is an Alawite homeland that somehow stretches across the border of Lebanon and Syria. A Sunni homeland. Now, we've got a certain model for this in what's happened to the Kurds in northern Iraq. It stretches mainly across northern Iraq, but a bit of the homeland goes informally into Turkey, a little bit informally into Iran. This may be the ultimate compromise, but you make a very good point. These borders are really artificial. I mean, they're imperially drawn up borders, and they took very little account of where the ethno-religious communities were clustered.
And of course, moving the discussion a little in nearby Turkey, we've seen now a split in what's been seen as a very solid conservative Muslim government in Turkey under Erdogan, with the Hizmet movement and Fethullah Gulen, a somewhat reclusive Islamic scholar, coming to the fore.
Yeah, Gulen, who now lives and has done for many years, lives in Pennsylvania. But for about 50 years, he's run an organization called Hizmet, which is essentially a service, I think, is the nature of it. Now, he and Erdogan's party essentially competed, not in electoral terms, but as far as hearts and minds, for the same group. That is, moderate Islamists, moderately religious motivated people who wanted Turkey not to be a hardline Islamic state, but to be sort of a state with a Muslim sentiment, a Muslim colour, Muslim culture, as it were. What's occurred is a falling out between those two groups. Erdogan is investigating the Hizmet movement for alleged corruption. Commission, thousands and thousands of Hizmet sympathisers in the police and in the judiciary have been demoted or they've been reassigned. This was a grassroots movement, and as I say, Erdogan relied on it for a long time, but now the coalition seems to have splintered. Gulen says, look, don't overplay this. He gave a very rare interview to the BBC saying, don't overstate this. But at the same time, Erdogan is trying to make our movement appear bigger and more powerful than it really is in an attempt to frighten people.
Yes, well, we can take all sorts of coded messages from that. Of course, the real interest for many is that if you get a split between those sort of reasonably conservative voters who've supported Erdogan's policies up until now, you could see an interesting outcome of the elections, which aren't too far away.
I'm not sure the extent to which Hizmet, the movement, actually mobilises and organises voters. And of course, the other thing too is, if you're an Islamic-minded voter, where else do you go but Erdogan's party? I mean, in a sense, the only alternative are the old secular nationalist parties. I'm not sure whether Fethullah Gulen's followers go to that party, but it is a weakening of a strong grassroots alliance.
Well, politics and religion also are a mix in the West. Some interesting figures have come out in Britain about the way in which religion and politics interact in the social sphere.
The Theos think tank, which does some really fascinating work on the religious complexity of Britain, especially now that it is such a multicultural country, had some very interesting findings. What it looked at was trying to align religious denominations and ethno-religious communities with how they vote. Now, one particular finding was not so surprising, and that is that most Anglicans in Britain have a leaning towards the Tory party. Many of them are more old-fashioned, welfare state, patrician-type Tories, but there remains a bit of a bias towards the Tory party. The other thing that wasn't so surprising was that Catholic voters in Britain tend to be more Labour-aligned. In fact, Labour-aligned by a significant proportion. Except in, you know, critical elections like in 1979 when Labour's vote collapsed. The same thing in 1997, Anglicans voted for Tony Blair and Labour in larger numbers. The interesting figures come when you look at the ethno-religious communities. So Muslims in Britain tend to be much more pro-Labour. Hindus tend to be pro-Labour. Sikhs tend to divide their vote between Labour and the Tories. Buddhists in Britain tend to be disproportionately supportive of the Liberal Democrats. Interesting commentary there. Are these Western Buddhists, as it were, attracted historically to the sort of Liberal Democrats' crunchy granola image? Not so much the case now. And then, of course, there are the traditional non-conformist religions in Britain, the Protestant denominations that have historically been in an alliance with liberalism, now split between the third party, the Liberal Democrats and Labour. The other counterintuitive thing, though, John, is that a lot of people who identify strongly as religious attend religious services regularly, weekly, sometimes more than weekly, and say that they're conservatives. In this survey, they have much stronger support for the welfare state and for higher taxes and much greater sympathy for the unemployed. So, you know, it's a counterintuitive finding.
So what you're suggesting is the stronger your religious commitment, however you tend to express it politically, your sentiments tend to lie with traditional welfare values.
That's right. Old tax and spend welfare values, according to Theos. So you may be a weekly church attender who identifies as a Tory voter, but you're likely, according to this study, to be more supportive and sympathetic to the unemployed rather than the non-religious voter who's actually taken a more cynical or hard-line position on things like unemployment and welfare. It's a fascinating finding, the Theos think tank.
And that's something yet to work out too, because they've also published figures on another thing, and that is the emergence of what's called blue labour. That is, conservative Labour voters, of which we've seen, we call them John Howard battlers here in Australia, haven't we?
Yeah. Very interesting point that you raise. There's an election in Britain in a little over a year, early 2015. Interesting to see how these alignments play out when it comes to the ballot box.
Well, we have a new Pope, Francis. He can't be called new now. He's settled in the job. He's been there for a little while. But he's still capable of producing surprises. And you've been doing a little digging yourself. You were off on leave. But true to your profession as a journalist, you couldn't help yourself. You went to Argentina and dug around to find what you could in Buenos Aires.
We did. We mixed business and pleasure. Buenos Aires, a great city. Very keen, though, to know how Buenos Aires, this sprawling city, once a stronghold of Latin America's biggest middle class, how did it shape the values of Pope Francis? Especially when you consider these public pronouncements in the last 2 months about economics. Just recently, only in the last couple of days, he made a statement describing usury, that is, you know, punishing interest rates, as a dramatic social wound. And one of the people we spoke to, a journalist who helped write the cover story for Time magazine, which named Pope Francis as Person of the Year, she pointed out that he has a very strong sensibility towards the poor, and he frequently, very regularly, went in the slums of Argentina with his priests who lived among the poor. He is very much shaped by what happened, the fate of the middle class in Argentina. Argentina historically had one of the strongest middle classes in all of Latin America. It had a middle class that rivaled Europe and Australia. It had a strong standard of living. It wasn't marked by dramatic differences in wealth and poverty, like Brazil, for example. In the late 1990s, there was an economic crisis in the early 2000s that saw the currency collapse, the income, the savings of the middle class were absolutely decimated. Well, more than decimated, devastated. And what he's seen there is that the middle class can be very vulnerable to the excesses of the market.
And of course, that gives us some insight into why he said what he did this week about usury.
That's right. It's an old biblical term for a phenomenon that continues. And there again, he's on the same page as the Archbishop of Canterbury. I noticed that just in the past 2 weeks in Britain, a local church has opened up its own bank, just as the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, said he would try to do, to try to drive out of business, not through regulation or legislation, but through competition, these usurious,
the payday
usurious payday lenders.
Yeah. Andrew West, presenter of the Religion and Ethics Report on RN on ABC Radio. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.